It's been more than 2 months since the deadly police shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, sparked community outrage and widespread protests. They have brought the uncomfortable issue of race in America back into the spotlight. At the same time, they have revealed how differently that issue is viewed by members of different racial groups. And the same goes for how each of us evaluates the criminal justice system itself. A week ago, a large group of activists, both local and from out of town, gathered for a weekend of resistance labeled Ferguson October, with support from the growing Moral Monday movement. And it was Monday that saw around 50 protesters, including a diverse group of faith leaders, arrested and charged with disturbing the peace. Joining us now is Pastor Mike McBride, who was jailed in Ferguson along with faith and secular leaders, including Dr. Cornell West. Pastor Mike is National Campaign Director of the Lifelines to Healing Campaign, part of the PICO network. Pastor Mike, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Great to be here with you. Thank you so much.
Would you start by just summarizing the events of this past weekend and into Monday and who the organizers were?
What is called Ferguson October, the Weekend of Resistance, was developed by a number of youth-led organizations and adult clergy allies on the ground and strategically placed across the country. Youth-led organizations like Hands Up United, the Organization for Black Struggle, Millennial Activists, the Lost Voices, a number of young people who have for 60-plus days been daily nonviolently protesting and calling for a more transparent system and process to justice for the killing of Mike Brown and most recently Von Derrick Myers. We, as the faith leaders and clergy who have some of us been there on the ground within the first week of the death of Michael Brown, joined in a powerful collaboration at their request and called faith leaders from across the country to come and join in an effort to lift up our moral voice. We had over 400 clergy join us, including Dr. Cornell West, Reverend Sekou, Reverend Renita, Pastor Tracy Blackman, Pastor Jamal Bryan, a number of clergy and faith leaders all across the country. And we were there together to listen, to hear, to be challenged by the young people, but also to express our moral outrage as faith leaders, provide an opportunity for repentance for ourselves, for showing up 60 days late, for the law enforcement agencies, for engaging in acts that we believe are very oppressive and violent, and for certainly all of us as a large community, so we can create some healing and bring justice to the region.
Why do you think it was important to add this level of visibility to these ongoing protests in Ferguson?
Well, I think people are failing to appreciate that this region, particularly St. Louis County, has a very, very troubled past, a very troubled legacy within the last couple of decades around police brutality. There are law enforcement officials who have been fired for falsifying reports, for engaging in police brutality, and then run for elected office. This has become institutionalized in the St. Louis County region, and the victims of the perpetuation of these policies continue to be poor Black young men and women, families who are often struggling to make ends meet. They are unable to move throughout the county freely because of focused policing that gives them bench warrants for moving violations, playing their music too loud, walking across the street outside of a crosswalk. It has created such distrust and such trauma, the killing of Mike Brown and all the witnesses and them leaving his body out there for 4 hours and the police cars coming, driving over the memorials later on in the day. I think it lit a few inside the hearts of these young people, and they said, we're not taking it anymore. It forced them then to say, you are not going to brush this under the rug like you've done so many times before. We're going to keep pushing for justice. And the visibility, in many respects, has created pressure to make sure that this is served.
Talk with me about the arrests. This is a longstanding tradition in civil rights activism. What purpose did it serve in this particular instance?
We believe that if there are laws that are on the books that are not just, then it is our duty as followers of Jesus, certainly I am a follower of Jesus, to not follow these laws. If those who are held responsible for enforcing these laws are not enforcing them justly, we believe it is our duty to resist to the point of violence, as we are all students and believers in nonviolence, to resist and expose the contradiction. The arrest, though we certainly had planned and were prepared to be arrested, was only there to amplify the two sets of rules that are at play in the city of Ferguson.
Right.
We were there to make sure that it could be put on display all across the world, the lack of conversation, transparency, the lack of communication, the enforcement of the law at a very inconsistent manner. It creates and breeds lawlessness. We were asking to enter a public building. We were not given any direction, any conversation. We knew that it was within our civil rights that have been fought some 40 years ago that we have access to public buildings. And the arrest was intended to show, in many respects, a very moral contrast. Even the charges, the outlandish nature of the charges that we've been charged with assaulting police officers, as we knelt down to pray when we were not able to move beyond the police line. These are all contradictions that are now on display for everyone to see. And it was done at the height of noon with all the cameras rolling and hundreds of witnesses. Can you imagine what is being done to our young people, our black and brown men and women, in the nighttime when no cameras around and no one is there but the police officers and our young people? It is an outrage. It is immoral. And we all should be putting up our arms, our legs, and joining this very important civil rights movement and fight for justice and dignity.
So in addition to the arrests, was there another moment from last weekend that stood out for you as being memorable or emblematic of this being a new civil rights movement?
Honestly, I believe that while the arrest was the most public expression of the contradiction of the justice system, I will say that the most powerful and healing, and dare I say, a long-standing moment, happened the night before. There was a very important program that was called Hip Hop and Hope, that Dr. Cornel West was the keynote speaker. And throughout the program, the number of speakers were largely clergy, older adults, civil rights leaders have flown in. And the young people were left pretty much in the stands and in the audience with only two representatives waiting to speak. In the middle of the program, the young people began to stand up, turn their backs. They began to do an action, if you will, a nonviolent but very public action on us, the adults, the clergy. It came to a point in which the young people were then invited on the stage and began to talk, and it was very painful to hear their thoughts and their rejection of our leadership and of our tactics. Some of it was laced with profanity. But the powerful moment was when the young people stayed, the elders, the clergy, the civil rights leaders stayed, and we covenanted and repented together to continue our work. That, I believe, has solidified the bridge, the intergenerational necessity of our relationships, and I believe it set the stage for the powerful work that was to come later on the next day, which was demonstrated by the young people themselves showing up to our rally after we had gotten arrested, and leading 400 clergy in their chants and in their declarations for justice, ending with them yelling, "We love you," and the young people responding back, "And we love you," ending with the young people showing up to the jails to wait for the clergy, the same clergy that they cussed out the night before. They came to the jails and waited for all of us to be released. That, to me, was the most significant moment, I believe, in this movement so far, and I believe that if all of us all across the country can imagine ourselves withstanding the initial fire and frustration and anger of our young people, appreciating that they will not communicate with us at first the way we may want them to, but if we lean in and build relationships, we can restore the hearts of our mothers to our daughters, our fathers to our sons, of our clergy and churches to our community members. And this is, I think, the most powerful moment of the weekend.
Thanks for sharing that. That was a great story. So while you were in Ferguson and in your contact with law enforcement there, did you detect any progress on them scaling back their overly aggressive policing in reaction to all of these protests?
So I don't want to sound too critical here. I think maybe I should just temper my remarks by saying I work with at least a dozen police agencies across the country. I work with the Department of Justice. We teach and train community police relationships. We teach and train the Oakland Police Department and many others on race and on implicit bias and on excessive force. So we are very well, I am very well in relationship with national police chiefs in national cities. So I want to temper my remarks by saying that. The second thing I will say, I am convinced that there is a very, very under-resourced and under-trained police force in that region. I believe that their tactics and their approach are very heavy-handed. They are not consistent. They do not use the principles of transparency nor accountability that are important for a community and police relationship that is littered and grounded in historical racial trauma, pain, and brutality. So while we have lost the explicit militarized responses, I still believe that this police force in this region has a long way to go to be trained on 21st century best practices in policing. We are able, again, in the city of Oakland, to point to how in our communities, we were averaging officer-involved shootings, not killings, but shootings, every 6 to 8 weeks for the past 20 years or so. When our work as faith leaders and community members started 2 years ago, we've begun to not only reduce the gun violence incidents in our communities, we have not had an officer-involved shooting in 18 months in the city of Oakland because of the work that we've been able to do working with police and law enforcement and community members. So I'll say this about what needs to happen there. They need to be open to bringing in the best thinking experts and colleagues in law enforcement and community police relationships, helping them to develop better procedural justice strategies, better legitimacy strategies, better use of force strategies, better transparency strategies. And I believe until they do that, nothing that they are doing on their own will suffice, and it will continue to escalate into very dangerous situations, of which I have a great amount of fear, quite frankly.
Right.
When these announcements around the indictment or lack thereof come back.
Right. And you've shown in your own community that these kinds of practices are possible. So there's
absolutely
an example and a model.
Absolutely. Right. And not only possible, but effective. And you don't have to wait a whole generation. I'll say it again, the city of Oakland, in which we live, 2 years ago, we averaged 135 gun homicides. This year, we're down to about 60. We don't have officer-involved shootings anymore. We have reduced the number of arrests, while we have reduced the number of burglaries, number of armed robberies, all kinds of crime reductions, but community relationships have been strengthened. This is possible, but it requires skill, it requires heart, it requires commitment, it requires political leadership, of which we've seen none in that region. The governor's a Democrat. The people raising money for Darren Wilson are Democrats. The mayors are Democrats. The congresspeople are Democrats. Even our president, attorney general, are Democrats. And they've done very little, in my estimation, to make sure that this is quickly resolved. We need leadership from the political structures. And if we don't get that, then we all will be responsible for the escalating tensions that I continue to be very concerned about.
Right. Pastor Mike, a few weeks ago, Robbie Jones of the Public Religion Research Institute was on this show telling Welton about how vast the statistical divide is between how white Americans and African Americans see our law enforcement system and our justice system. And what was really striking was that the shooting of Michael Brown had a big negative impact on African American responses to those questions, but hardly any impact on how white Americans answered. So if there continues to be this disconnect between these communities, how do you engage everyone to work together?
So we should not be surprised by this, particularly because if there is no proximity of relationship and even a location as relates to our folks, regardless of their culture, regardless of their economic background, people will experience the world differently. The reason why our communities experience it this way, number one, is because we are over-policed in our communities, which then continues to feed the criminalization narrative that all of us across the country, I think, have drunk from the wells and in many ways eternalized. What we've done, and through our Live Free campaign and through the PICO Network, has intentionally attempted to engage people across race to have conversations and share stories, to enter into people's pain, to appreciate again that all of us have been victimized. I'd love to share another story while we were being processed. There were at least three members of the Justice Center who were processing our arrest who expressed to us, and they were all white, that they resented that they were being put in this position to even enforce these laws. Wow. They were feeling as if they were being forced to choose between doing the right thing and putting food on their table at night. And they encouraged us to keep doing what we're doing, but please be careful and protect ourselves. It is important to appreciate that structural racism oppresses everyone,
right?
Not just the victims of violence, but even those who are being forced to fulfill roles in oppressive systems. It is critical for us then to find those allies, those stories, and lift them up, elevate them, so people do not feel as if this is not impacting them. Whether you are white, black, brown, whether you are gay or straight, whether you are rich or poor, all of these structural, racist, oppressive systems need to be dismantled so we all can live free and have the dignity that God has given to us. So this is our strategy, and we're working with evangelical organizations, CCDA. We're working with the Exponential Church Conference. We're working with Word Made Flesh, World Impact, Fuller Theological Seminary. I mean, a number of evangelical folks, largely white and Anglo, who are feeling the burning in their soul and realizing that we all must be evangelists of this gospel that includes justice and fairness for everyone, and that we're seeing great results.
Pastor Mike McBride is National Campaign Director of the Lifelines to Healing Campaign, part of the PICO Network. He leads the Way Christian Center in West Berkeley, California, and was one of the faith leaders arrested last week during the Days of Action in Ferguson, Missouri. Pastor Mike, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It has been my pleasure. God's blessings to us all.